Okay, so this is the 43rd Derech Hashem class, and we are starting the chapter on inspiration and prophecy. And it's interesting, I had a good question today. It's Erev Purim, almost. I mean, we're in the Erev zone of Purim, Rosh Chodesh Adar. So I was teaching about the Megillah today, and somebody asked me if it was written with prophecy. And we have a whole long conversation, so let's just talk about that for a minute, just to put things in perspective. So the Megillah is written with prophecy. That's how we rule, although it was questioned at the time. And it's written right at the end of the era of prophecy. So, and what I think confused this person was the English word prophecy as opposed to the Hebrew word nevuah. So we'll look at both of those for a second. So it's interesting. So the story of Esther is right at the end of the 70 years of exile after the first temple is destroyed. And it's right before we start building the second Beis HaMikdash. So I don't know if you're aware, but the first Beis HaMikdash was destroyed because of Avodah Zarah, because of idol worship. And our Chachamim understood that that Yetzer Hara was still very strong in us and would destroy the second Beis HaMikdash also. So before the second Beis HaMikdash was rebuilt, or whoever they were, whichever group of Chachamim or Nevi'im or whatever the group was, davened hard for the Yetzer Hara, for Avodah Zarah, to be taken away from us as a people. And it was. But, so what is Avodah Zarah? It's a complete disconnect from Hashem. Right? If our sages tell us that anger is like Avodah Zarah. So what is anger? When somebody's so angry, they can't see anything but what they're angry about. Hashem disappears, and it's just them and their anger. So it's like Avodah Zarah, right? Avodah Zarah is a total disconnect from Hashem. So if Avodah Zarah, if the Yetzer Hara for Avodah Zarah was taken away from us, Hashem runs an even-handed world, and so something else had to go too.
So
something
it's
else
taken
on the positive
away from us?
Side. Yeah. So the Yetzer Hara for Avodah Zarah was removed from us. The Yetzer, we still think we have a Yetzer Hara for Avodah Zarah, which we do, meaning a lighter weight Yetzer Hara for money, for power, for fame, those kinds of Avodah Zarah. But apparently there's a Gemara that discusses how strong the Yetzer Hara for Avodah Zarah was, where one Amora, I think, is speaking back in time to a Tana. Anyway, there's a conversation between time where, or maybe speaking to a Navi probably, where the person in the Gemara says, I don't understand you guys of your time that you ran so fast to Avodah Zarah. Like, what was the big deal with Avodah Zarah? He's speaking post the time of the Yetzer Hara for Avodah Zarah. And he's questioning his the people that came before him, the Gdolim that came before him. So what was up with you guys? How are you nichshel in this so easily? How did you fall down on this? And that person answered him from back in time and said to him, if you would have been alive in our time, you would have, now you have to imagine the way sages were dressed at that time in their long flowing robes, right? He said, you would have lifted your skirts and run to worship idols. Meaning, it was a Yetzer Hara that we can't understand today, how strong that Yetzer Hara was. Probably like, although even stronger, but imagine the strength of the Yetzer Hara of checking emails at the table on your smartphone. You probably can't imagine that, but other people listening to the call for sure can. You know, I heard actually a story on Shabbos where somebody said to their father, I wish I was your phone. And he said, what? He said, yes. Somebody said, look, what do you want to be when you grow up? He said, I want to be a phone. I want to be my father's phone. He says, what? He says, yeah, my father takes his phone wherever he goes. And when he's at the table, he's constantly checking it. And when the whole family gets in the car, instead of saying, did everybody buckle up? He says, did I bring my phone? So I want to be my father's phone. So
it's a malady.
Yeah. So, but the thing is, people are, I mean, it's such a Yetzer Hara. People have such a hard time hearing that little note that says an email came in or a text message came in. While they're looking at somebody else and having a conversation, they turn and they check. If they're pulled so hard, it's so hard not to check your phone. Or even imagine not on Shabbos during the week when the phone, the regular house phone rings during dinner time. You just sat down. It's so hard to to focus just on having a meal with your spouse and children and not go answer the phone. It's such a pull. So that's just a tiny little taste of what a Yetzirah is like that keeps you distracted, distracted, distracted. The Yetzirah for idol worship was so strong that the Jews were succumbing left and right. So it is a Yetzirah of disconnection, total disconnection. So just like our phones disconnect us from relationships that are around us, so Avodah Zarah disconnects us from a relationship with Hashem. So if we have the Yetzirah taken away for that relationship, for a disconnect with the relationship with Hashem, then in order to keep free will even-handed, Hashem had to take away something else also to make it an even world, even up the score a little bit of where our Yetzirah could head. So what Hashem took away on the positive side was Nevuah, which means that Nevuah has an equivalency to Avodah Zarah in opposites. So Avodah Zarah is the disconnection from Hashem, and Nevuah is deep, deep connection to Hashem. So we think of Nevuah, or certainly in English, we think of prophecy as saying the future. But really it's much, much more than that, as we'll see. But even just looking at the Megillah, we can see that. Because we do understand in L'dvar Halacha, it has been ruled that the Megillah, Megillat Esther, was written with Nevuah. That's why it's in the Tanakh. Right? All the Sifrei Tanakh were written with Nevuah. If it was just Ruach HaKodesh, which is a lower level, which we'll see, or just divinely inspired, like a few nice thoughts, it would not be included in the Tanakh. So it was a question. Megillas Esther is the last book chronologically in the Tanakh. Everything else was written before that. So the question was this written with Nevuah or not? You see, Esther wrote it in the end of the book. It says Esther wrote the book, right? So the question is, how did she write it? Did she go and interview all the players? I mean, Esther wrote it, but how did she know everything that happened? Right? How did she know the king didn't have an easy time falling asleep that night, and so he called for his chronicles to be read out loud to him? How did she know what story he read? How did she know what the conversation was between Bigthan and Seresh? You know, how did she know that it was Haman who was waiting in the hallway who came in, and the conversation between the king and Haman? What would you do, the king asks Haman, if the king wanted to honor somebody? How does she know all that stuff? You know, and Haman was already dead when this was written. Did she go and interview each player in the story so she could write an accurate account? So it's possible that she did a little research or talked it over with Mordechai before she wrote it, but she is considered one of the Sheven Neviot, one of the seven prophetesses. Mm-hmm. So the book is not a prophecy of the future, although there are a few prophetic lines like this book will be read forever, won't be forgotten, this is truth, things like that. But the other stuff is actually past, right? The book was written after the story happened. It was not written before the story. So it did not prophesy the future. This is what's going to happen. It's a book that chronicles the past. It has a lot in it. It's a very deep book. There's so many interesting threads, which is not the point of this class. But it's fascinating to read each year. There's so much stuff in there. But the point is, it was written with prophecy. So one definition of prophecy is the ability to channel Hashem's words into the world. Whether those words are of revelation of future events or of understanding of past things. So another example of past things would be David HaMelech, who wrote all 150 Tehillim, but some of those Tehillim were written before him. So at least one, and I don't know which one, but one was written by Adam. A few were written by the B'nai Korach. A few were written by others at different points in history. But David HaMelech was able to channel them all and write. So he's the one who put pen to paper and wrote down all 150, even if they weren't all his exact authorship. But he's the one who brought them into the world.
So he didn't have a record of them.
No, so it's not like maybe he did have a scrap of paper here or there, but the B'nai Korach, he didn't. I mean, they were in halfway between the earth and Gehenna, right, on a little ledge there, whatever, that's what the Midrash says. Where were they? Where did they write those Tehillim? He channeled them, however it was. Maybe he did have a Masorah from Adam HaRishon passed down to him, but I doubt it. You know, I think he was able to pull it from the ether, things that had already been written and thought, he was able to channel. That's how Tehillim was written, because Tehillim is also a prophetic book. That's because it's one of the 24, so it has to be written with nevuah if it's in the Tanakh. So there are some psukim of Tehillim that are prophetic for the future, for sure. But there are also things that are from the past that are chronicling things or that have to do with different personalities that he channeled. So part of nevuah, one definition of nevuah, is the ability to be so connected to Hashem that you can channel Hashem's word into the world, whether it's future, past, or present, whatever it is. But it's actually a deeper thing than that, because we understand that there were prophecy schools. Certainly during the first Beis HaMikdash, there were schools of prophecy. And I think my guess is that some of those schools of prophecy had some lessons that might overlap with inner Torah lessons, probably not exactly the way that it's taught, but the understanding of deep awareness of who you are and how you connect and breath and body kinds of things and the connection was a very important part of prophecy training, prophet training. And we do know that there were schools and there were over a million prophets during the first Beis HaMikdash, or during that era of prophecy. There were over a million prophets. Now think about a million prophets, okay, and the Jewish people at the time. Because that's before the 10 tribes were lost. So you have all the Jews in the land, basically. There's no exile, really, at the time. So basically, the entire Jewish population, mostly, is living in Eretz Yisrael during the first Beis HaMikdash time. So, what is that, around, let's just give it a generous number, 10 million Jews. That's a lot. Right, right now in Eretz Yisrael, there's about 6 million Jews and a few million others. Right now, the whole land has about 8.5, I think, million people in it. So this was a time when there was 10 million people, 10 million Jews, who knows who else was living there, in the land of Israel. If there was a million prophets, well, I guess that's only at one time, so I was going to say it's 1 in 10. It's probably less than that because it's spread out over time, over a few hundred years. But still, a million prophets, let's just say over those few hundred years, I don't know, 50 million Jews lived because of being born and died, right? Still, you have 1 in 25, 1 in 50 people as a prophet. Right? It's a lot. That means everybody knows somebody who's a Navi at that time.
So what was their role as a prophet?
Right. So that's what we want to get to, is what was that? Because they, not all those people were there to bring the word of Hashem into the world. That was not the only role of the Navi. So with that in mind, now let's look at our text in Derech Hashem, and then we'll hopefully it's going to answer it, but if not, we'll get back to that answer. But let's look inside with these questions raised, okay? So let's just look in the English. My plan is to do the first four paragraphs today. Okay, so inspiration and prophecy. So paragraph number one, which of course is more than one paragraph. God ordained that man should naturally be able to teach himself, understand, and reason with his intellect, and thus gain knowledge from his observation of things and their properties. So first of all, that just means God gave us a brain, and we're supposed to be able to use it. So with our brains working correctly, the way Hashem planned, without barring mental illness and barring brain trauma, a regular brain is supposed to be able to understand and reason and use one's intellect to gain knowledge from his observations of things and their properties. So that's basically science. We should be able to look at the world and figure stuff out. On the basis of this, man is also able to infer and deduce things that are not immediately apparent, and can thus gain a more complete understanding of things. This is the natural process of human reason. So, for instance, we see the sun come up and the sun go down every day. So at first we might think the sun disappears or the sun goes out or something like that. But the more, because that's what we observe, right? But then the more that we observe and we see shadows and we start to figure out there's a curvature of the earth and start to see the movement of stars, et cetera, and write all of that down and continue to infer and infer, and we can finally understand that the sun doesn't go out at night. It just goes beyond the horizon to a place that we can't see. And that's certainly something that as human beings we figured out before there were spaceships, before we could go out there and look and just observe. We figured out quite a bit of things from math or from inference, from mixing different pieces of information together. That's the natural process of human reason. God also decreed, however, that there exists another means of gaining knowledge that is much higher than this. This is what we call bestowed enlightenment. So the first one, the first type of knowledge, our regular knowledge in Hebrew, is called Haskalah Hativit, Hativis, however you want to pronounce it. Haskalah, mm-hmm. Right? Haskalah, Hativit. And the second one is called Haskalah Hanishpa'at, of influenced or bestowed enlightenment. Bestowed enlightenment consists of an influence granted by God through various particular means, especially prepared for this purpose. When this influence reaches an individual's mind, certain information becomes fixed in it. So this is really when Hashem allows something to float down into your mind, but he causes it to go there. And then certain information is known in your mind. That, if it just stops right there, if it's just like kind of a light knowing, we might call that Ruach HaKodesh, although we'll see the definition of Ruach HaKodesh in a second. Or we might just call it divinely inspired insight, or we might just call it an insight, and we don't actually know where that came from.
Is that kind of intuition, like when people just know things?
So sometimes there are intuitions that are just intuitions, right? That and it might be that that came from Hashem. We don't know for sure. So an intuition area is the gray area. Once it gets to Ruach HaKodesh, you know. So let's see how he defines it. He perceives this knowledge clearly, without any doubt or error, and knows it completely, with all of its prepositions and corollaries, as well as its place in the general scheme. This is called divine inspiration, Ruach HaKodesh. So when you know for sure, and I don't think that we get to much of this level today, we pretty much understand that there's not Ruach HaKodesh today, although there's little breezes of Ruach HaKodesh that blow through our lives. One place that we experience it is, for instance, in naming children, is considered to be a place of Ruach HaKodesh, that for some reason the parents are zeichet to either choose correctly, or when they pronounce, have an influence over, through the pronouncing of the name, the neshama of the child is somehow tied into the name. That's why we don't change names. It's not like an English name where you can just, if you're named Susan and one day you decide as an adult you don't really like Susan, you'd rather be called Sunshine, right? You can go and get your name changed to Sunshine and everybody can start calling you that and it doesn't matter. But if you're named Shoshana and that's what your parents named you, that's your name forever. It can never be changed. You can't say, I hate Shoshana and I'd rather be called, you know, anything else, Razy. Too bad. That's your name is Shoshana. It's bound into your essence. So once the name is given, there is often the name is derived in a Ruach HaKodesh way, where somehow the parents have a feeling. They're drawn to a name that has a connection with that person's neshama. Once the name is given, it is tied into that person's neshama. So there's Ruach HaKodesh in that. But apart from that, we have very little bits. Pardon?
Often parents don't have a real knowing. They're just going to choose a name and go by whatever feels best. But there isn't that sense of clear knowing.
Right, so it's not a clear knowing. That's what I'm saying. It's not this. It's just a breeze of it. We don't have this today, mostly. I mean, there may be some gedolim here or there who have this. We don't have nevuah today, for sure, at all. But even this level of Ruach HaKodesh, where you perceive that knowledge clearly, without any doubt or error, and you know it completely, with all of its prepositions and corollaries, as well as its place in the general scheme, so you get it, that's called Ruach HaKodesh. Very few people experience that today. But we do just get a little, a wisp of it in naming, just a wisp. And I don't think everybody gets it. That's the truth. I don't think everybody gets it. But there is an understanding that parents somehow have it, that they whatever they're drawn to, they do go with what feels right. And that's why sometimes there's so much angst over what name to give. You know, the parents are drawn to a certain name, and the grandparents, you know, want it named after somebody, and the parents either hate that name. I had a pediatrician who had four daughters, and then stopped at four girls, never had a son. And somebody joked that the reason why he never had a son is because his father died young. His father's name was Colonimus. So he would have had a name after his father if he would have had a son. So he had four daughters. So sometimes there's a name you just can't stand and you don't want to have to use it and people are pressuring you. But that's often why parents keep the name private until, I mean, there's Einhara reasons, who knows what they all are. But I think just for Shalom Bais, also parents often keep the name private until they actually name in shul, because once it's named, done. There is no changing it. You can't go back and change it. Even for, I knew somebody whose name was Nimrod, an Israeli guy. I called him at his house on the phone, and I spoke to his mother. I said, Shalom, Haim Nimrod Nimtzeh. And she said, Ken, Rak Rega. And then she said, Nimi, ha telephone bishilcha. Like, Nimi? That's his nickname? Nimrod, Nimi. So for people like that who become from and have a name like Nimrod, which is a Klela name, they are often advised to change their name, but they can't really. I don't know what they do in terms of ketubah or legal documents or aliyah to the Torah, but I think they add a name at least, like Yaakov Nimrod, something like that. So they should be called Yaakov in their daily life. But so we do add names, but we can't change them. Anyway, so that is one reason why parents keep it quiet. And we do have a tradition that there is some divine and some Ruach HaKodesh, because that's the word that's used, is Ruach HaKodesh, whether that means a lighter weight one than this, or there's something special about naming children. Anyway, let's move on. So we have so far two different ways of attaining knowledge. One is through the natural process that we're familiar with, and the second one is through some kind of influence that flows into your mind that you have clarity about that came from Hashem. Two, in this manner, one can gain knowledge of things otherwise accessible to human reason, but in a much clearer way, as discussed above. On the other hand, one can also gain information that could not be otherwise gained through natural means. This includes such things as information concerning future events and hidden secrets. Okay, so Ruach HaKodesh would be a way for both. So let's say you're a Tana in the Gemara and you don't live in a time in which we've already figured out that the sun goes around the earth. But you could channel that through Ruach HaKodesh and know that. That is a way that you could get information that could be derived from observation, but was just granted. So that's one way that it could be used. It's information that you could get through natural means over time, or it could just be, you could just be let know that information. Or it could be that you get information that you can't get through natural means, like Esther knowing what the conversation was between Bigthan and Seresh, or knowing what the conversation was between the king and Haman. How could she know that? That's only through Ruach HaKodesh or Nevuah. And that's the only way she could get that information. Because otherwise, it wasn't written down, and Haman was dead already. Who knows what that conversation was? But it's written down, so somehow she did. So that's another way, that's a way that you can get that information. Or future events. Number three. This experience, however, can take place on many different levels. These may involve the power of its influence. So the levels are the power of its influence, the time when it is granted, the manner in which it reaches the individual, and the nature of the things revealed and communicated in this fashion. So power of influence, time, manner, and nature of information, those four levels. In every case, however, the influence comes in such a manner that its recipient is clearly aware of it. So this is not dreams where you wonder, or an insight where you're just not quite sure. It seems so clear, but that makes sense. But did Hashem give it to you or not? Like here with Ruach HaKodesh, you know. It's also possible, however, that such influence be extended to a person's mind so that he can clearly perceive a given concept without his being aware of this influence. In such a case, it is experienced like any other idea that arises spontaneously in one's mind. In a broader sense, this is also called divine inspiration or hidden influence, in the words of our sages, even though it's an actually much lower level. So there is such a thing as that idea popping into your head, and it could be influenced by Hashem, but you don't know for sure. So that's just called a hidden influence or divine inspiration, not Ruach HaKodesh. But that's just, let's see, where's the word in Hebrew? It's just an influenced thought, but it's not considered Ruach HaKodesh, a hidden influence, or it's the lowest level. Let's say if Ruach HaKodesh, maybe you could see Ruach HaKodesh as a spectrum of influenced thoughts, and on the highest level of the spectrum, you're absolutely aware that Hashem is influencing you to know that thought, and on the very lowest level of that spectrum of influenced thoughts is an influence that's hidden, that you don't even know that Hashem is influencing you, but still you get a little piece of information that way.
Mm-hmm.
True divine inspiration, well, however, let me
what about people who can tell the future?
Hang on one second. True divine inspiration, however, is a clear and vivid experience to the one worthy of it, and he is highly aware of its influence. Okay, what about people who can tell the future? So there's a few different ways to tell the future. So as we've learned earlier in the book in different places, we have a concept of Sitra Achra, for sure, the other side. And literally that means the other side, although it often is used in the pejorative to mean the negative side. We have, in our community, we have two sides of town. So I live on the firmer side, and there are some women who come from the more modern side of town to study with the Rav over here. And he often teases them that they live on the Sitra Achra. They live in the Sitra Achra because they're on the other side. But it just means the other side. But really it means like the dark side, the negative side, the Kochot HaTumah as opposed to the Kochot HaTahara. So as we've seen in other places, one can access energy. One can accomplish things through different routes and with different sources. So it is possible to accomplish things from Kochot HaTumah and or Kochot HaTahara. So in the last section on theurgy, let me just read that word in Hebrew. So that whole section is called Hapu'ulot, Hapu'ula b'shemot u'b'kishuf. So in English it's just called theurgy. Theurgy means the ability to use Shemot Hashem to accomplish certain tasks, whether you're using it to influence Hashem directly, which is still indirect, but saying a name of Hashem which causes something to happen, because Hashem allowed that thing to happen if one would pronounce that name of Hashem, or whether it's through influencing malachim, through influencing angels, by pronouncing one of their names, which causes them to behave in a certain way, which then causes an effect to happen in the world. That would be called theurgy. That would be called hapu'ulot, hapu'ula b'shemot. That's a mutter type of way to behave. Or, so let's say it's dry, right? We need rain. So somebody who understands how to influence the malachim to send rain, or who understands how to influence Hashem to let it rain, could say one of those shemot. If they're in a place of total tahara, and this is, I believe, is how, you know, there are tales of Hasidic rebbes doing things like this, whether they stop a forest fire from burning, or they cause rain to come, or they cause a flood to stop, a river to stop rising so it won't flood. Things like that, forces of nature, can be controlled by using Shemot Hashem or Shemot HaMalachim if you know how to do it. Let's say you don't know how to do it, or you're not kadosh enough to do it in that permitted derech, but you still want to, let's say, instead of stop the forest fire, cause a forest fire. Or let's say you're an Indian rain dancer, right? And you just want rain because you're in the plains and they're dry and you want to bring rain, but you don't even know about Hashem necessarily, but you know how to make it rain. So that would be drawing on kohot hatumah. There are pathways that a person can use that are negative pathways, drawing on negative forces to cause things to happen in the world. The same if that's true, there's different ways to tell the future. There are people who can tell the future through true ways where they have a handle, they can see certain things. But I would say most of the people today who actually can, who aren't just lying, because there's all the shysters out there who aren't telling the truth, who are just, you know, swindlers taking your money to tell you something, and they some of them are very crafty. They know what they're doing. They know how to read you, read what you're wearing, read your emotions, read your even your smells and different, you know, what you're emitting to them. They can pick it up and figure out how to say the right things to you. And they know how to say general things and make it more specific based on your reactions. Those people are swindlers, and they know how to take your money. They're not actually telling you anything, and they're not telling you the future either. But there are some who can access kohot hatuma and share things from that. And it's whether it's kohot hatuma or kohot hatara, we're not permitted to go to future tellers. Fortune tellers, future tellers, really. It's future tellers that are the problem. Fortune teller is usually a future teller. I mean, if you go to a fair and somebody's just, you know, having fun, some people will say you could do that if you know for sure it's not a real thing. It's just a joke. Somebody's in a costume and they have a crystal ball and they tell you, you know, you're going to have 14 children and be very happy. Great. But anybody who's really trying to conjure anything, that's a real problem in Torah. It's usur. You're not permitted. Especially because we understand the strength of Koach HaDibur, and that when a human being, any human being, Jew or non-Jew, because they're human and because Hashem created the world through the pathway of speech, He gifted human beings with the creative power that's expressed through speech, and also a destructive power because things are kept in balance. So we can use our language to destroy or to build, and we want to be very careful in what we pronounce. So we're not supposed to pronounce somebody's future. And even in dream interpretations, which there is such a thing, but if somebody tells you a dream, since you have Koach HaDibur, you're not supposed to, you shouldn't translate it for the negative, even if it's a terrible dream. You should say only the positive. You know, if somebody dreams, if somebody tells you, you know, I saw a neighbor kid get hit by a car and die, you know, you should say, oh, that's a dream about increased neighborhood safety and how we all have to, you know, take care of our children. It's not a dream about something negative that happens. It's a dream about good. You have to interpret for the good because we have Koach HaDibur. It makes a difference. So somebody who can tell the future, I think most are lying, and some really can access kohot hatuma to do it. And basically somebody who can see the future from kohot hatahara is not going to tell you about it because they don't have the right. Right? So I find it's fascinating in my own experience. I've often seen that, you know, certain Kabbalistic ideas are only supposed to be shared with small groups or one-on-one or just by hints. So I find sometimes, I never know exactly what I'm going to say in a shiur until it comes out. Sometimes when we go to a place in a shiur that was a little deeper and a little more mystical, at the end, when I think, oh, that was such a geschmacka class, I look at my recorder and I see it didn't work for whatever reason. But I find that happens regularly, that there are times when it's not supposed to be recorded. And I found it yesterday. Somebody called me who's on a conversion pathway. And she's already in conversion classes, so she's already a non-Jew that you're permitted to teach some Torah to, because she's already clicked into a real class, not just somebody curious, right? Because in general, you're not supposed to teach non-Jews Torah. So she asked me, she wanted to know, were Adam and Eve Jewish? And if they weren't, why not? And how did Jews come about? So I knew the answer to that, so I started telling her. When I got to the end of the explanation, which I was giving half to her and half to my daughter, because really the person called my daughter, and she handed the phone over to me. I really wanted my daughter to hear it so she'd be able to articulate it the next time. Then I paused, and I realized she wasn't on the line. Her phone had died. And she did not hear most of what I had to say. And I looked at my daughter, I'm like, I think I went too deep. This was not meant for her. It was just meant for you. So you never know. Anyway, Hashem protects you too. There are certain things you shouldn't be sharing. So certainly somebody who knows the future from Kohot HaTahara is probably not going to be sharing. So I would be very careful of people who are sharing future information. Either it's a lie or it's a Kohot HaTuma, basically. Kohot HaTahara, future knowers, are not sharing. Okay, let's do the last paragraph because this, I think, will help answer that question that we left open before we started the text, which I forgot exactly how we articulated it, but hopefully we'll get to it when we finish reading this. Okay. Oh, yeah, what was the role of all those prophets? Number four. There is another level, however, that is much higher than such divine inspiration. This is the level of true prophecy. This is a degree of inspiration where an individual reaches a level where he literally binds himself to Hashem in such a way that he can actually feel this attachment. He then clearly recognizes that the one to whom he is bound is Hashem, in a manner that will be discussed shortly. This is sensed with complete clarity, with an awareness that leaves no room for any doubt whatsoever. The individual is as sure of it as he would be if it were a physical object observed with his physical senses. The main concept of true prophecy is therefore that a living person achieves such an attachment and bond with God. This in itself is certainly a very high degree of perfection. Besides this, however, it is often accompanied by certain information and enlightenment. Through true prophecy, one can gain knowledge of many lofty truths among God's hidden mysteries. These things are perceived very clearly, just like all knowledge gained through bestowed enlightenment, as discussed above. Prophecy, however, comes with a much greater force than divine inspiration, as we shall explain shortly. So that's going to be the next class. But this is what I want to say. If we hear what's being said here, prophecy is not about revealing information. It might also come with information that's revealed. But that's not the main concept, right? Let's look back here. The main concept of true prophecy is therefore that a living being achieves such an attachment and bond with Hashem. That's the main concept, that a person who's still alive can take their neshama and bind it to Hashem so tightly without losing it, without having the neshama leave the body, that they cleave so clearly in life to Hashem, that they actually channel Hashem's energy into the Jewish people through themselves. So sometimes they also channel information, but really they're just touching Hashem, so to speak, in a way that's so tight that they become a channel for Hashem's energy in the world. Sometimes just during that time, I mean, hopefully we all become a channel, you know, for Hashem's energy in the world, but to really be somebody who shines Hashem's light in the world strongly. I mean, again, we can all work on accomplishing that, but what actual prophecy means and why they had schools of prophecy is so that people could learn how to get their ego out of the way enough, how to get their physical self out of the way enough, that their neshama could cleave to Hashem while they're still alive. And it would just be for short periods of time. It's not how they lived forever. But they would go into, and we'll see as we continue what prophecy looks like physically on a person, but that they would be able to go into a state where they would cleave to Hashem so tightly that, and you might say, why? Why do that when you're alive? You're going to do that when you're dead. Why spend time doing that when you're alive? But the cleaving so tightly allows a human being to channel a divine energy into the world. And since we're all connected to each other, it nourishes us. That energy nourishes Klal Yisrael at its root. So it's sort of like delivering fertilizer into Klal Yisrael, a sustaining energy. So it helps balance, let's say, those people who are doing negative things, those people who are Ovdei Avodah Zarah, and create a disconnect. That disconnect affects all Klal Yisrael too. So people who are unkind or treat people poorly harm Klal Yisrael. And people who are extra kind, who are machnas orchem, who give a lot of tzedakah, who walk around with a smile on their face, they help Klal Yisrael. Not just the person that saw the smile, but that person that saw that smile and felt better because of it, the bond that was created, the energetic spark that was exchanged between them, nourishes all of Klal Yisrael. Even if it's just a little drip of nourishment, it does nourish all of Klal Yisrael. It affects us all. So negative and positive affects us all. So the job of a Navi was to, in their core, meld with Hashem so strongly that they channeled divine energy into the entire Am to help us, to nourish us spiritually. And sometimes along with that information also came. Not always, but sometimes.
Right. And on a personal level, what did it do for them?
I think that created that higher, I mean, we've all seen people who have a hadras panim, you know, a shining face, because they are more connected to the divine. So I think it probably gave them greater clarity on a personal level in their life, where it didn't take away their free will, because we're supposed to be creatures of free will, but still gave them greater clarity to be able to move through the world and on a different plane. So, and you can see that in people. I'm trying to think of examples off the top of my head, which aren't coming right this very minute, but you can see how people live on different levels of clarity, and their bechira is different. So where one person, has to choose if they're going to, one person is choosing at the end of their meal if they're going to bench or not, because they don't feel like it. Right? They washed, because that's what everybody did. But now people got up from the table, nobody's going to really know if they benched or not. Now they have to decide, am I going to bench or not, right? So that's the person who's considering, in a way, an aveira, or skipping a mitzvah. Where another person on a higher level who understands, you can't really skip a mitzvah. Like, it's other people don't see, but Hashem sees, and you're going to miss this opportunity. So somebody lives with that level of clarity. You could say, well, their free will is taken away, whether they should skip benching or not. Well, is it? That person who never skips benching on purpose, never, ever, their bechira point is moved past that. They might miss it by mistake, but they never skip it on purpose. That person's still wondering, they still have free will, when they look at what there is for lunch and think, I don't know if I want to wash. Right? What are they saying about, I don't know if I want to wash? They're just going to have crackers instead or rice instead, right? They're saying, I don't feel like benching. So... that's what they're saying, right? So they're not going to do the avera of not benching when they should. They're just not going to put themselves into the space of needing to bench, which they are on a higher level. Their bechira is operating on a higher level, but they still have a yitzhara not to wash.
Right.
Right? So it can go up and up and up and up and up and up and up, all those levels. You know, people can constantly go up. There's a story of whatever Hasidish Rebbe went for Tashlich and threw his Averas away. And all his Hasidim went and gathered up all the breadcrumbs that he tossed. Why? Because his Averas are their mitzvahs. That's what they said to themselves, right? So he benched, but he lost Kavana over a sentence. You know, so for him, that's an Avera. He should have been paying attention. They are thankful to have Kavana for everything except for one sentence. How great is that? They've never achieved that level before where they paid attention to everything except for one sentence in benching. They want that avera. For them, it's a mitzvah. So everybody has a different level of where they're holding. So I think that for somebody who can achieve nevuah, it helps them ascend through the levels. So they get to higher and higher levels of clarity. They still have free will based on their level. But they achieve higher and higher levels for themselves personally. And that then influences Klal Yisrael in a different way, because we're all connected. You can't do anything without influencing a Klal.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where we're going to end for today. Okay, mm-hmm. So it's the first four paragraphs. And next week, no class because I'll be in Mexico. And the following week, does this time work for you? Do you want to do it again
the following week? What day is that Purim?
I think it's Shushan Purim.
Should be okay.
Let me just check and see. We can be in touch by email if you want to and see what happens. Or I'll switch it to night. Okay, so let's see. That's the 25th, February 25th, which is Shushan Purim. So let's just be in touch by email if that time will work. But meanwhile, I'll put it in the calendar just in case.
Okay. Lovely.
Okay.
Thank you.
Great. Thanks. So nice to talk to you. Okay.
Yeah.
Have a great
Take
week.
Care.
And Purim. Okay. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.